So, a little over 50 years ago, the April 1966 Cosmopolitan cover featured a story on tranquilizers. I think we have a picture of that there. There we go. And we had a 1966 Life cover with Louis Armstrong. Look magazine had a story on Barbara Streisand. And then, of course, there was this magazine cover. Needless to say, it caught the attention of people at the newsstand, becoming the magazine's best-selling issue since two decades prior. So why that cover? That question then? The most direct answer is that in the 20 years since the Holocaust, people had had time to think about what had happened in terms of their understanding of God. An omnipotent God should have stopped the Holocaust. A God that couldn't, that could, but didn't, was no less than a monster. And a God without the power to stop it is perhaps a useless God. The number of angry readers there at time that sent letters that suggest many found this question unbearable. But at the time, Unitarian Universalists found themselves in a fairly comfortable place to deal with the death of old notions of God. After all, UUs in one form or another have always had a unique relationship with the God concept. If you're new to us today, here's the difference between Unitarians and Universalists in a humorous nutshell, mildly humorous nutshell. Historically, while most God believers were concerned about the possibility of hell, the small-town humble Universalists thought God was too good to send them to hell. Big-city, not-so-humble Unitarians, meanwhile, thought they were far too good for God to send them to hell. It's true. This faith has always had a certain confidence in thinking it knew at any moment in time what God was or wasn't. We've had our phases in believing in a loving God, no hell, no damnation, a silent cheerleader God, God as a peace within each of us, and of course, no God at all. Whichever God was de rigueur at the moment, we UUs were convinced we had firmly rooted our understanding of it in reason and rationality. The way the God concept has evolved throughout our history suggests that we might have been overconfident in the infallibility of our logic. I'm reminded of the story of the children in a UU church school class who were busy drawing pictures. The teacher asked one, "What are you drawing a picture of there?" "I'm drawing a picture of God," was the reply. "Oh, but nobody knows what God looks like," objected the teacher. "They will," said the UU child, "when I get my picture done." Leave it to a child to go forward with instinct while grown-ups try to rationally answer impossible questions. Half a century ago, the question was, "Is God dead?" And now the question has perhaps changed. Rather than, "Is God dead?" it's, "Was God ever?" Karen Armstrong's now classic 1993 book, The History of God, which I'm told by our librarian, Ed Chabron, we have one copy over there in the community room, so it's first come, first serve after the service. But her book attempts to answer that question, beginning with tracing the origins of God. So anthropologists go back to a time long before written history, a time where humans, in an effort to make meaning of the tragedies and mysteries of their lives, worshipped one god, called in some cultures the high god or sky god. This god is still worshipped in some African cultures today. This god was distant, otherworldly, and remote, and basically disconnected from people's everyday lives. As early as 14,000 years ago, these early humans were looking for ways to understand what was around them. The sun, the wind, the stars, the moon, the sea. Importantly, Armstrong says, When people began to devise their myths and worship their gods, they weren't seeking to find a literal explanation for natural phenomena. The symbolic stories, cave paintings, and carvings were an attempt to express their wonder and to link this pervasive mystery with their own lives. So I don't know about you, but for me, it can be easy to assume that people thousands of years ago were crudely guided by brute emotions, but evidence suggests that they, like us, wrestled with complex emotions, abstract thoughts, and even metaphor. In an attempt to both seek answers to the origin and meaning of their existence, and to feel closer to that distant high or sky god, people gradually began to turn to intercessors, gods we now know as pagan gods. Already we see a theme that emerges in Armstrong's book and in our own Unitarian Universalist history. Humanity creates its concept of God or gods to conform with what is needed at the time. By the 8th century BCE, the Israelites started developing a distinct God vision of their own. The gods of Israel's pagan heritage, who'd been both territorial and pragmatic, were being replaced by this creator God who talked and instructed, and his words became central to the three major monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. God then further evolves according to human needs. The authoritarian creator God of Genesis gives way to the tribal God of Israel, and then the triumphant God of Moses, who was then replaced by the sorrowful God of Isaiah, and on and on. To read and study the Hebrew Bible as a whole is to recognize the distinct characterization given to God based on the circumstances and needs of the time and context. So I'm reminded of another apocryphal Unitarian Universalist story. Unitarian Universalist was out in a boat fishing. Without warning, the Loch Ness Monster rose up out of the lake and picked up the end of the boat, flipping the Unitarian Universalist way up into the air. The monster opened its mouth wide. As the Unitarian Universalist fell towards those sharp teeth, he cried out, "Oh my God, help me!" Suddenly, time froze. As the guy hung there in midair, a huge voice boomed out, "I thought you didn't believe in a personal God on whom you could call in times of crisis." "Give me a break, God," said the Unitarian Universalist. "A minute ago, I didn't believe in the Loch Ness Monster either." This speaks to two things. One, humanity's inclination to make of God what they will based on their needs of the moment. And two, the questioning of theological so-called truths in moments of personal crisis. Eventually, every human being will be tasked with facing something that is more than they thought they could. If you can't think of something in your own lifetime, I'm genuinely glad for you, but I do suggest, in the immortal words of Betty Davis, "Fasten your seatbelt, it's going to be a bumpy night." Because that thing, more often than one thing, it comes for us all at some point. Might be the death of a loved one, illness and disease, those fractured relationships with friends, family members, addiction, financial troubles, moral failings. Something bigger. Bigger than we thought we could handle. More than we can do. Our own personal Loch Ness Monster. This has always been true for humanity. It's not new for us. From the beginning, we humans have been surprised by life. Events have awakened our deepest fears, giving birth to our greatest sorrows, and leaving what we thought we knew about the world in the dust. In the aftermath of whatever crisis may have rocked our lives, we are left looking around, trying to make meaning, and perhaps most of all wanting something to lean on, an idea to lean into, something that will offer our lives the dawn of a new hope when we are otherwise hopeless, and will hold and support us when we otherwise feel alone. So throughout human history, this universal characteristic we all share has led many human beings to find that dawn in the God concept. A certain something that helps us carry on when the world has happened to us. Now, I'm not saying that that something is an actual being called God. It might just be the natural reserves of the human brain and our will, our fortitude, hiding behind a door that needs some metaphorical, imaginative key to unlock. But as we know, calling upon God without putting our own human potential into action, that tends to be ineffectual. Thus the frustration many of us feel when there's yet another violence happening, another shooting, as there was so recently, and people send their thoughts and prayers rather than taking action, responsive action. And the invoking of God has absolutely been used to justify atrocities, a problematic legacy indeed. A few years ago at another church, I preached a sermon about building bridges of understanding across those in the congregation who identified as atheists, agnostic, and believers in God, and then lots of people who didn't identify in any particular way. One 40-something-year-old man was quite disgruntled by my sermon, to put it mildly. I know that look in the eyes when they're coming down the reception line. "I need to talk to you," he said, standing just a little too close to me. "Sure," I said, and he brusquely agreed to set up an appointment in my office for later that week. During the subsequent coffee hour, I was busy milling around talking to people when he approached me again. "I just can't wait," he said. "I have to talk to you now. Do you know what it's like for me hearing that word?" "God," I asked. "Yes," he said, this time more loudly. The people around us stopped talking and looked our way. He went on, "It must be like when you hear the word," and then he used a three-letter F word that is a slur for gay people. "How do you like that?" Clearly, this man was trying to inflict pain upon me, and for a moment, I absolutely felt like responding in kind. But then I wondered what he'd gone through that made him react in this way. Later, I did have a couple more conversations with him, not easy conversations, and one of the conclusions that he came to was that based on the abusive experiences he had gone through in childhood, too often in the name of God, he had a lot of work to do until he could deal with the occasional presence of that word. Mostly, I think he wished we UUs would just stop being a multi-faith, multi-belief community. And I don't think we're ever going to stop that. When I came to Unitarian Universalism, I would have probably been most comfortable if everyone believed as I did. But what I quickly found was that my experience of worship and life was incalculably enriched by being part of a community of different beliefs. What I didn't expect is that my beliefs would evolve with time, inclining me to personally lean into mystery and uncertainty, where I find more richness for my creative spirit. It's like the light of the cathedral in the metaphor from Forest Church that Carlos and Casey read earlier. I don't know if the light we all share is God or just our common humanity. I just want to be in the light with those other seekers who have found their way here. And I'm open to the idea of translation across the differences in our understanding. A very forthright minister that I know, when I told her that story of that guy approaching me and you know, complaining about the use of God at all in a service. She just looked at me and she said, "Did you ask him if his translator was broken?" And I appreciate that, because I think part of the work that we do as people across faith differences, and Lawrence, none of this is in the notes on the slides if you're worried about where the heck is Jason. I hear about this later at lunch, you know. But our work as Unitarian Universalists is to translate across our differences, to recognize that other people don't use the same language that we do, but we're all trying to make sense of our lives, okay? All right, I'm back on script. So, is God dead? In the 19th century, the era of Karl Marx, Charles Darwin, Nietzsche, Sigmund Freud, did humanity even need God anymore? Moving into the 20th and 21st centuries with the sobering Holocaust, the rise of technological warfare, the inability, a current inability to discern fact from propaganda despite previously unimagined communication tools, good God, now an almost quaint concept against the backdrop of real human selfishness and misery disseminated onto our TVs, laptops, and phones, could God have any place in our world now? Karen Armstrong says, "We're lucky because we have a new intellectual freedom and can boldly follow up our own ideas without pussyfooting gingerly around difficult articles of faith." What she means is God is for humanity to freely consider anew in this new age, or responsibly reject, if that is your choice. Maybe our collective work in this century, the century we still have yet ahead, is to wholeheartedly and wholeheadedly respond to the basic human impulse for making meaning of our lives, because that's intertwined with the motivations that originated God in the first place. Because I'll tell you, there will always be a hospital room where someone is in bed facing the unknown. Because there will always be those moments when you look in the mirror and you wonder what you should have done or are supposed to do with your life. Because there will always be times when you sit in a room full of people and feel alone. Because there will always be the actions of politicians and other leaders who put the lives of the vulnerable at risk. Because of all these things, we don't necessarily need God, though that might be the answer for you, but we humans need some sort of answer, even if the answer just begets more questions. We need to have some way of making meaning of the challenges of our world. God has been one way throughout time. But the work of this community is to help you find your way, whatever that might be. And you are indeed welcome here on your journey. The magazine cover I want for your life is not a question about what is dead, but what lives. What is your way? How do you rise from the darkness and make your way out into another dawn?